Voting officials are preparing for an election shaped by the pandemic, and that's sparking what could be a record number of lawsuits.
A lot of them having to do with vote by mail or absentee voting, you know, whether, given we have social distancing, you should be able to avoid requirements in the past, like having somebody else witness and sign your ballot, time for getting the ballots in, how to deal with postal delays.
And with next week's Democratic National Convention largely going virtual, Milwaukee business owners are putting away the welcome signs.
They were expecting about $200 million in revenue, about 50,000 people coming in, and now they're going to see very little of that.
It's Friday, August 14th. I'm Kateri Yoakum for The Wall Street Journal. Here's what's news. New data out today from the Commerce Department shows retail spending is back above pre-pandemic levels. Sales at stores, restaurants, service stations, and online grew by 1.2% in July. That's the third straight month-over-month increase. Our reporter Josh Mitchell has been looking into the numbers.
One of the things that's going on right now is Americans aren't spending as much on vacations. They're not traveling nearly as much. And so therefore, they have a little bit more money to spend on other things like appliances, or there's been a lot of home repairs going on. People are spending a lot of times in their homes, and so they're fixing stuff up that they otherwise wouldn't be doing right now. So I think overall, retail spending has been pretty solid in the past 3 months, but you have to keep in mind this is only one segment of the economy. It's a big part of the economy, but there are still a lot of clouds hanging over the U.S. economy right now. So overall, it's a good trend, but with unemployment still at 10.2%, we're nowhere in the clear right now.
Another sign of caution, those retail numbers are from July. More current private sector data collected for early August, after the expiration of the federal government's enhanced unemployment benefit, points to slower growth in spending. A former FBI lawyer who worked on surveillance warrants against one-time Trump campaign advisor Carter Page is expected to plead guilty to a false statement charge. Lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith has admitted to altering an email used to justify Page's surveillance over suspicion about his contacts with Russia. This is the first criminal charge stemming from a review of the investigators who worked on a probe into Russian interference in the 2016 election. As drug makers work on developing coronavirus vaccines, there have been questions about how they would be distributed and where people would be able to get them. Federal health officials announced today that McKesson, one of the world's largest drug wholesalers and the biggest vaccine middleman in the U.S., will be a main distributor of COVID-19 vaccines, should the shots prove to work safely. Under the terms of the contract, McKesson would distribute the vaccines and related supplies to clinics, hospitals, and other sites that would administer the shots. McKesson shares were up more than 4% at the end of trading. And the U.S. Postal Service says it's adding new peak fees on commercial packages starting in October, as it tries to offset increased expenses from coronavirus and a surge in volume expected from online shoppers during the holidays. The added costs won't apply to retail or international shipments or regular mail services. The Postal Service lost $2.2 billion in the quarter ending June 30th. A big increase in package shipments wasn't enough to offset plunges in its more profitable marketing and first-class mail division. And the agency has come under increased scrutiny under new Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a Republican fundraiser and logistics executive who took the role in June. Speaking of the Postal Service, mail-in voting is the focus of multiple election lawsuits. We'll talk about those and more after the break. The general election is less than 3 months away, and Republicans and Democrats are engaged in down-to-the-wire contests to persuade voters and to persuade the courts. A slew of election suits have been filed in some key states, so many that 2020 is actually on track to set a record. Our legal affairs reporter, Brent Kendall, joins me now to talk about it. Brent, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Brent, tell me about these lawsuits. Where are they being filed and what big issues are at stake?
Well, we have lawsuits in pretty much most states around the nation. I mean, there are some key battlegrounds and areas where both parties are focusing more because the stakes are higher. But, I mean, you know, in an election year, there's typically all sorts of suits anyway on things like polling places and different deadlines and the like. But everything really, you know, has been thrown for a loop this year because of the coronavirus pandemic. So you have state election officials all over the country kind of on the fly having to figure out how to manage their election systems in a public health environment that they've never had before. So that's raised all sorts of issues, a lot of them having to do with vote by mail or absentee voting, you know, whether given we have social distancing, you should be able to avoid requirements in the past, like having somebody else witness and sign your ballot, time for getting the ballots in, how to deal with postal delays. It's by and large Democrats and their allies, think civil rights groups, voting rights groups, who have pushed for a range of changes to rules to take into account the pandemic. And Republicans, generally speaking, you hear them articulating concerns that any concessions that are made to deal with the virus could have an impact on election integrity and make it easier for people to game the system, which is something they don't want to see happen.
Have we seen any of these cases be resolved so far?
Well, so a lot of these are working their way up the ladder. We've had some, you know, in an emergency posture land at the Supreme Court already. But for the most part, I mean, it's the next 60 days or so where we should see a lot of these things really get worked out to the point where we know what the rules will be. I mean, so far, the Supreme Court, for example, declined in Wisconsin to extend deadlines for when election officials could accept absentee ballots. Then on the other hand, just this week in Rhode Island, you had a case where the state there wants to have more expansive mail-in voting, and Republicans challenged that, and the court in that case, again, sided with election officials and said, look, this is what they want to do. It's not really our place to intervene and tell them otherwise.
Do we have any sense about whether there are winners and losers so far in the decisions that have come out?
Well, so it depends on which states you look at. I mean, the voting rights advocates have won in Montana. They won a important settlement in Minnesota, which is going to be a key state in the election. There are a lot of states in which they won initial rulings and then lost at the appellate level. And so now we're kind of in a situation where we'll have to figure out where things are going to go. For example, in Texas, a judge originally ruled that you could vote absentee for any reason if you were afraid of catching the coronavirus. And then an appeals court said, no, you can't do that. So now there are further proceedings scheduled there. There's a big case, it doesn't have to do with the virus, but it's in Florida about felon voting rights. The state there, in a constitutional amendment, restored voting rights for hundreds of thousands of people in Florida with felony convictions. But then the state legislature came along and said, well, no, you know, even after you've completed your sentence, you have to make sure you've paid all your fines and any other government fees that you owe before you can vote. And so there's litigation on whether you can condition the right to vote on these people being able to pay fees, which in many cases they don't have the money to pay. So we have a key court hearing on that coming up. And depending on how that comes out, I mean, it could either allow or take away, you know, hundreds of thousands of voters in the Florida electorate.
Yeah, that was my next question. What impact could these decisions have on the outcome of the election?
I mean, it's really all about voter turnout. I mean, both sides want to get their voters either to the polls or get their ballots in the mail or dropped off somewhere where they can be counted. And so the practical impact that could be had is that, you know, if you're able to get more of your voters to cast ballots, the better off you're going to be. And so, you know, in a lot of these circumstances, you see Democrats pushing for rules changes that will optimize the ability of their voters to get out and do these things. You know, on the Republican side, they are focused on turnout for their voters in different ways. And there are some people who have expressed concern that their fights against easing rules could actually backfire and limit some of their own voters who would like to vote absentee. But for them, the big issue really is this whole notion of orderly and fair elections. And you know, they've raised the specter that, you know, when you have all these changes in procedures in such a short period of time in states that aren't really well equipped to deal with them, it's just a recipe for potential misconduct or chaos, which is what they don't want to see.
Brent Kendall, legal affairs reporter, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The Democratic National Convention kicks off next Monday. If you can call it a kickoff, it was scheduled to be held in Milwaukee, but now most of the events and the speeches will be held virtually. Political conventions normally bring a big boost in revenue to their host cities. This year was supposed to be no different, but now, of course, with conventions being held virtually, Milwaukee and Charlotte, North Carolina, where the RNC was scheduled to be held in 2 weeks, are both suffering. Our reporter Nora Eckert is in Milwaukee right now, and she's been talking to some of the business leaders there. Hi, Nora.
Hi, Kateri.
All right. So obviously, the Democratic National Convention has changed its plans a number of times over the past few months. Can you just get us up to speed on what's going to be happening next week there?
Yeah, there have been a lot of changes over the last few months. I mean, first, the date was changed. It was originally scheduled for the week of July 13th, and then it was bumped back to this coming week. And then it also moved location from the Fiserv Forum, which is where the Milwaukee Bucks NBA team plays, to the smaller Wisconsin Center. But then after that, delegates were actually encouraged to not go there. They were asked to participate remotely. And most recently, which was quite surprising for a lot of the people I spoke with there, presumptive nominee Vice President Joe Biden announced he wouldn't travel to the city and would instead accept his nomination in Delaware, which is his home state. So right now it's looking like most of the convention, if not all, will be virtual.
And you've been talking to a lot of business leaders there. I'm sure they had started preparing for a much, obviously much bigger convention with a lot of delegates in town. What are they saying?
So this was a big event for Milwaukee, and they were expecting about $200 million in revenue, about 50,000 people coming in, and now they're going to see very little of that. And of course, that's rippling down through the local businesses. I talked to an owner of an events company in Milwaukee. His name is Mike Jerkin, and he owns a company called Magic Productions that does lighting and sound for a lot of the events associated with the convention. And he said this is having a tremendous impact on his business.
Yeah, I mean, it's significant revenue loss for our company. I would say, you know, in the high hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not over, you know, probably closer over $1 million of lost revenue from all the events, you know, both official events, both corporate, you know, lobbyists, all those people.
I'm sure a lot of other businesses, hotels, restaurants were expecting more traffic.
There were a lot of restaurant owners and bar owners in the area who were really planning on this to be a boost for their business. I talked with one man named Paul Wiggum. He owns a restaurant called Mi Casa Su Cafe in Milwaukee, and he actually expanded his space in anticipation of the DNC. He was already planning up this about 100-seat expansion for his restaurant, but he said that when he heard about the DNC coming to Milwaukee, he really ramped that up. And now that the convention has been downsized so much, he has no choice but to move forward with it because it's already paid for.
All right. So next week is the DNC. The week after that is the Republican National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. You spoke to some of the business owners. Are they going through the same kind of tough times?
Yeah, Charlotte's been on a roller coaster ride, too. I mean, you'll remember that there was this flip from Charlotte to Jacksonville, and then Jacksonville was canceled. One of the main stories that stood out to me was a man named Vinay Patel. He is a principal at a hotel company called Sri Hotels. And he said that he was kind of holding out hope that this would be a boost for his industry. Even after he saw coronavirus cases rising, he thought that there still was a chance the city could get a sizable bump from this.
This was finally an opportunity for us to get everybody back and give them the hours that they need.
And Mr. Patel said he's estimating losses around $3 million for his company because the convention isn't happening in the size that it was planned to.
All right. Well, we'll still be watching the DNC and the RNC. I'm sure they will too, even if their restaurants and hotels aren't as full. Nora Eckert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kateri.
And that's what's news for this week. Our hosts are me, Kateri Yoakum, filling in for Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Mark Stewart. The show is produced this week with help from Paolo Bosnan, Nora Eckert, Mark Garrison, Shelby Holliday, Amanda Llewellyn, Charlie Turner, Sam Westren, J.R. Whalen, and Chris Zinsley. We'll be back on Monday morning. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.